Only one of us on this podcast has a career on stage.
Dance experience.
I would like for you, listener, to guess which one of us it is. Aaron, tell us about your experience on the stage as a thespian.
Okay, so I did dance lessons for 2 years in kindergarten and in first grade. Well, it was for Miss Simone's dance studio. And my sister went all throughout school at Miss Simone's. My cousin Kate went all throughout schools at Miss Simone's. And I think my mom knew early that I was only there for the lollipop at the end. You got a dum-dum lollipop at the end. And guess what? When my sister went there and I didn't, Miss Simone still came out and gave me a lollipop every week when I picked her up.
So you going to dance lessons was the equivalent of you going to like a bank or a dentist's office.
Yeah, pretty much. It really felt like it. I had a few of those hobbies. And so kindergarten, I did one song, When I Grow Up.
I was going to say, what song?
Not the Pussycat Dolls. And then the second year when I was in first grade, we did two dances. One was video dancer. I want to be a video dancer.
Singing lessons too.
And then the other one was Good Ship Lollipop.
Okay.
And I had a traumatizing experience with Good Ship Lollipop because I had these standalone sleeves and they kept falling down. And I would just like stop during the recital and push up the sleeve. It was so bad.
This sounds like a mess.
So then I stopped doing dance. And then years and years later, I pulled curtains for Beauty and the Beast, Florence Township Memorial High School's production of Beauty and the Beast.
Ooh, I'm going to talk about Beauty and the Beast later.
And then, oh yeah, me too, actually.
Then you probably will say the same thing I did.
And then the following year, my senior year, I was like, you know what? I think I want to be on this stage. And so I tried out for Bye Bye Birdie. I did a little singing. I did a little monologuing. And I actually got a pretty big part. But it turns out that I got the only part that has no dancing, no singing. And in fact, there was a song for my character with an optional monologue that you could do in its place. And they didn't give me the option. They said, you're doing the monologue. Now, that being said, it was before I knew you, very soon before I knew you. But your girl was the hit of the show besides the lead. Well, Lorraine obviously was the best, but besides Lorraine, I was getting the claps, the applauses, the hoots and the hollers.
And look where it got you, right here as a worldwide entertainer.
And I have to entertain 13-year-olds every single day.
Which is honestly the toughest crowd you could possibly
100%.
All right.
Okay, I'm about to do a quote, and you have to name the movie.
Okay.
Fosse, 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 Martha Graham, Martha Graham.
Oh, what is it from? I know it, but I don't know it.
Go Robin ahead. Williams?
Birdcage?
The Birdcage. Yes. Yes. Whenever I think of Bob Fosse, that's what I think of.
Yes.
Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. I'm Aaron.
I'm Tom.
This is Baby's First Watch List, the podcast covering a movie we had no background or expectations for.
Literally none. Can I hit you with the tagline right off the top?
Yeah.
All that work, all that glitter, all that pain, all that love, all that crazy rhythm, all that jazz.
This is not what I would expect
watching
this movie.
Does not represent this movie whatsoever.
No. But I loved watching it with no kind of expectations or background.
It was great. I loved it.
It was great. We watched 1979's All That Jazz, right? 79?
79. Christmas time, 79.
Christmas 79. Yeah, perfect Christmas movie. See it with the whole family.
I'm going to say this now. Up top, I just watched the Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel segment they did on this movie. It was like part of the whole, there was a bunch they did. Like how they recapped every week. They did like 5 movies or whatever. I watched a little segment they did on this one. Ebert didn't love the movie. He said that as he was walking out, there was a lady behind him who said, and this is going to be a spoiler for the plot summary, but the lady said, usually when you go to a musical around Christmas, you don't expect to see open heart surgery.
Literal, like you literally see it.
Yeah.
This musical drama was directed by legendary choreographer Bob Fosse, who wrote the screenplay with Robert Allen Arthur. Do you know anything about Robert Allen Arthur?
I know he died before this movie came out.
You're about to find out something else, too. Real, okay. Real good. So Fosse, who was a Best Director Oscar winner for Cabaret.
71?
73, I think. Which is what I thought this movie was.
72. Cabaret was 70. So okay. He won in 73.
73. He is the only person to win an Oscar, a Tony, and an Emmy in the same year.
And I'm pretty sure they were all for directing.
And I'm pretty sure they were all in 1973.
And it wasn't like a... Like, it wasn't like a BS
award. No, it's legit.
He was directing all of these things.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
He was known for his choreography. So he choreographed musicals like The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. All three of those are so good. Damn Yankees is such a good play. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No.
I did, like, the year that I did the high school play, I did the whole circuit with, like, all the local places that a couple of us gal pals would go around, and, like, we would see what Seinert was doing and what Burlington City was doing and what Bordentown was doing and what Northern was, whatever. We would go to all the plays. Burlington City did Fiddler on the Roof.
Can I just circle back real quick to what he won for? So he won the Oscar for Best Director for Cabaret, as we mentioned. He won the Emmy. He won three Emmys that year for Outstanding Variety and Popular Music Program, Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Comedy, Variety, or Music, and Outstanding Achievement in Choreography, all for Liza with a Z.
There you go. Which
is obviously a Liza Minnelli special concert film. And he won the Tony for Pippin.
Pippin, right.
For Choreography and for Best Direction.
Yep. It's insane.
Insane. All in the same year.
I wish he got that Grammy.
And arguably, like, Pippin's not even his best musical. Arguably.
Right.
You know?
There was a revival of Pippin kind of recently that did really well.
And Cabaret, arguably not his best movie, because I'm sure there's some people who prefer this to Cabaret.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Wild.
Yeah. He also did Sweet Charity, Pippin, and Chicago on Broadway. Also a film director, Fosse was known as an innovator of a specific dance style and jazz hands. He, like, really started off. He's like a super. He was super into jazz hands.
I think it's amazing that the guy who invented jazz hands made this movie.
It is truly insane. So Arthur, his co-writer, he was Mr. B. Arthur for a couple years.
Wow!
And that's how she got her name.
Wow!
But he spelled it in a different way.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. And he did a lot of stuff that ended up being like Sidney Poitier projects.
Okay.
And he died of lung cancer before this film's release. He was only in his 50s.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
He won. They won one of the Oscars was never mind.
He was nominated.
He was nominated, right.
Yeah. So the film starring Roy Scheider and Jessica Lange, even though Jessica Lange's like doesn't have that much to do in it.
This was her second movie.
Yeah.
Or second, beautiful. Like, big movie. Her other one was King Kong.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I know her from the, like, American Horror Story stuff.
They, so I listened earlier to the Blank Check podcast, and it was on All That Jazz, and it had Lin-Manuel Miranda on it. And they talked about how Jessica Lange was cast here because, like, she was just, like, hot. Like, she was, like, alluring, and they thought that she could fit as, like, an Angel of Death figure. Mm-hmm. And she was excellent in King Kong, so they were like, all right, well, let's throw her in. Let's see what she can do in this one. And also, because Bob Fosse is much like his character in the movie.
Yeah. So, the movie was semi-autobiographical.
Wait, I won't go too far into that, but I will say that as Bob Fosse was attempting to make his advances, Jessica Lange was, he would dance. Mm-hmm. For her, like, his move was, like, when he wanted to get with a woman, he would dance, and that would be, like, him, like... being all thing. But at the time, she was married to Mikhail Baryshnikov, who was like
the most famous Russian ballet dancer ever.
The greatest dancer like in history.
She's probably like, wow, cool.
Yeah. And then she was like, my boyfriend, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, oh.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
And Jessica Lange, she's no shrinking violet either. She'll tell you how it is.
Yeah.
So the film was very kind of semi-autobiographical. Largely about Bob Fosse's life while
that's
he was...
That's a hard semi.
Yeah, it really is. It just seems to be about him. it was about his life while working on Chicago on Broadway, like getting it off the ground, and a film, Lenny, about Lenny Bruce. And it's about his fascination with death after he had a heart attack while he was working on these things.
And Lenny, he was also nominated for Best Director for.
He was, right. The film stars many figures in Fosse's real life, including some of his paramours.
Yes.
They play his...
Anne Rankin is the main one who mm-hmm. plays Katie, his mm-hmm. girlfriend.
Yep.
Who was his actual girlfriend at the time.
Right. While he was married, he was married during this time, right?
I don't know. He might have been separated.
He wasn't with...
So during this time...
Verdon yet?
No. Oh, he was with Verdon. Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was 1980. I don't know why I thought it was 1980 because he died 7 years later. But yeah, they were married in 1960.
Yeah.
And Anne Rankin was the girlfriend. And
no, I think there were a couple girlfriends in it.
And what do you mean?
Like in the movie.
Oh, no, there were. Yeah. But I mean, Anne Rankin played his current
girlfriend in the
mistress
movie. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the movie. Yes.
Right. It's a wild. Fosse was wild. With 123-minute runtime, All That Jazz was a success. It made $37.8 million on a $12 million budget. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in 1980, and it was nominated for 9 Oscars. Picture, director, actor, screenplay, cinematography, and it won art direction, costume design, editing, and score.
So just a note on that, in my little Ebert research, I found that this movie, it was kind of a sleeper. Like, people didn't expect it to get that many Oscar nominations because it was very polarizing. If you've seen this movie, you can tell why.
Makes sense.
It almost reminds me of like when The Favorite got all those nominations, mm-hmm. where it was like, this movie got 12 nominations.
Yeah,
like, people either loved it or hated it. It kind of gives me that type of vibe where it was like, I don't know if it was ever The Favorite to win because apparently Kramer versus Kramer was just a huge smash that year. Apocalypse Now came out that year.
Yeah.
It was one of those where it was like, oh, wow, that got 9 nominations. And of course it only won Below the Line, but still the fact that it was seen as a big achievement for it to get all those nominations.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It was the last musical to be nominated for Best Picture until 1992 when Beauty and the Beast was nominated.
What I was going to say.
And it was the last live action musical to be nominated until 2002. Do you know which movie?
Chicago.
No, that was 2004.
2004.
I think.
I don't know.
Moulin Rouge.
Right. Because Moulin Rouge came out in 2001.
Yep.
Yeah, right.
So when it came out in 1979, Stanley Kubrick, who is mentioned in the film, did you see this?
This was one of my trivias.
He called it the best film he thinks he's ever seen.
They joked about about that on the Blank Check podcast. They were like, he was probably sitting in his house, which is basically the hotel from The Shining.
Yeah, it was like, whoa.
Heard his name and be like, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, heck yeah. Later in 2001, of course, this movie was preserved by the Library of Congress. Something else that I thought was really interesting, in 2012, the Motion Picture Editors Guild listed the film as the 4th best edited film of all time based on a survey of its membership. And that's straight from Wikipedia. I got
that. The editor kept talking about how bad Roy Scheider was at like dancing and singing and stuff. And he was like, He was like, this was a tough job for me.
Well, and I know
because we watched... Nick Pelessi gave us his DVD, his Criterion DVD, and there's some extras on the Criterion DVD, and one of the extras is commentary from the editor, and the whole time the editor is like, you can't really see it here, but like, this was tough with him trying to dance and do this scene.
Well, a lot of the editing is what is seen as very influential.
Oh yeah, it's frenetic.
It's frenetic. It also is very, it's not super plot-based.
Oh,
it cuts to like back and forth and this dream time and that time. Sequences throughout, right? And then repetitive stuff from the beginning of each day. Like, so there's a lot of like kind of like weird cuts that I think is much more common nowadays. Mm-hmm. And back then was seen as like kind of like wild.
Yeah.
Do you want to guess what numbers 3, 2, and 1 are for the best edited films? I can give you a hint.
Do I have any chance? Yeah, give me a hint.
One came out the same year.
Apocalypse Now.
Yep, that's number 3. One is older, like way older, and like the best film.
Citizen Kane.
That's number 2. And number 1 is our Queen editor.
Thelma?
Yeah.
Is it Goodfellas?
It's not Goodfellas.
Taxi Driver?
Nope. She didn't do Taxi Driver.
Oh, yeah, right. Listen to our Killers of the Flower Moon episode. What am I missing? Raging Bull?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That scene is
one. Yeah, totally.
I was like, Thelma.
Yeah.
So this movie is very influential in cinema, but not just in the movies itself. The movie has been referenced in an episode of Glow. There's an entire Better Call Saul episode that seems to be on this.
Yeah.
And a David Fincher directed Paula Abdul music video used the plane song.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like as inspiration. Erotica
or whatever it's called.
Yeah, exactly. And it's for Cold Hearted. He's a cold hearted snake. You know that song? And it was just recently that music video was cited as inspiration for Ariana Grande's video for Yes and.
Oh, wow.
So if you watch that, which I thought that the inspiration for Yes and seemed to be Vogue, but who directed Vogue? David Fincher.
Yeah, David Fincher.
So I think that's really interesting. And especially because David Fincher wasn't one of the many directors I thought of when I was watching all that jazz as being influenced.
Yeah, really,
by
no.
It.
So I'm sure he is.
It's actually really cool that, like, yeah, Vogue and Cold Hearted are both
David Fincher.
David Fincher.
They're both the guy who did Seven.
Yeah.
Zodiac. Mank.
So
it's been a while since we mentioned Mank on the podcast.
Enough Mank. So it also, all that jazz, was heavily featured in the show Fosse Verdon. Fosse Verdon was a Ryan Murphy production. And
miniseries, right?
Yeah. I think it's like 9 episodes or something like that. And Sam Rockwell plays Bob Fosse. Michelle Williams, Queen, is Gwen Verdon.
The only reason I knew of the show
is
because...
Her name Gwen?
Gwen, yeah. Is because I felt like Michelle Williams was nominated like 8 Emmys in a row, even though it was one season.
Yeah. and in this one, it's like part of it is the filming of all that jazz. So now I kind of have to... I feel like I have to watch this show now.
I would not be uninterested in watching Fosse Verdon after watching this movie.
Right? So yeah, just the fact that Ariana Grande's new video uses that as inspiration keeps that all that jazz legacy alive and well.
Yes.
And of course, for an NJ connection, Roy Scheider, star of All That Jazz.
Our
and
God from Jaws.
Jaws. He is an NJ boy through and through. Although he died in Arkansas. Ugh. I didn't know when he moved from.
When he left New Jersey.
New Jersey,
it was all
downhill. He was born in Orange. He's a Rutgers grad.
Yeah.
And he even spent time before his acting as an amateur boxer, winning all but one match.
I saw that. It was like, this is the best record we have of this. I'm not 100% sure if it's totally valid.
No, it's valid. So there's our New Jersey boy. Without the great state of New Jersey,
there would be no All That Jazz.
There would be no All That Jazz.
Actually, it would have just starred somebody else because there was like a billion people in talks in this movie.
Yeah, but at the same time, Roy Scheider killed it.
He was amazing. The movie falls apart without him. Yeah. Like, he's great.
Amazing.
Want me to do the plot?
Yeah.
All right.
But keep it real PG.
We'll see about that. Joe Gideon, played by Roy Scheider, is a Broadway director, choreographer, and filmmaker in the process of casting the chorus and staging the dance numbers for his latest Broadway show, starring his ex-wife, Audrey Paris, played by Leland Palmer, in what is largely a vanity project for her, playing a role several years younger than her real age. He's also editing a film he directed on the life of stand-up comic Davis Newman. Joe's professional and personal lives are intertwined. He's a chronic philanderer, having slept with and had relationships with a series of dancers in his shows, including Victoria Porter, who he hired for the current show, and Katie Jagger, played by Anne Rankin, his current girlfriend. That philandering has led to relationship problems with Audrey during their marriage and potentially now with Kate, who wants a committed relationship with Joe. Joe also lives a hard and fast life. He's chain-smoking, drinking heavily, listening to hard-driving classical music, I think it was Vivaldi, and popping pills to keep going, in addition to pressures from investors and meeting film deadlines above and beyond his own self-induced hard life, he is teetering on the brink physically and emotionally. With Katie, Audrey, and his and Audrey's teenage daughter, Michelle, looking over him as best they can, Joe flirts with Angelique, played by Jessica Lange, who is like a angel of death figure in like all white and a veil and all that, in the process.
Of course, her name is Angelique.
Yeah. Joe eventually has a massive heart attack and ends up in the hospital.
You see it, too.
You do.
You see the heart surgery.
As he goes on life support, he directs extravagant dream sequences in his own head, starring his ex-wife, girlfriend, and daughter, who berate him for his behavior. He realizes he cannot avoid his own death and has another heart attack. As the doctors attempt one more time to save him, Joe imagines a monumental variety show featuring everyone from his past, where he takes center stage in an extensive musical number called Bye Bye Life, which is a kind of a cover of Bye Bye Love, the Everly Brothers. In his dying dream, Joe is able to thank his family and acquaintances as he cannot from his hospital bed, and his performance receives a massive standing ovation. Joe finally dreams of himself traveling down a hallway to meet Angelique as the film abruptly cuts to his corpse being zipped up in a body bag. All that jazz.
The ending's iconic.
It's an incredible... It's one of the best like ending sequences I've ever seen.
The last half an hour is just amazing.
Staggering.
Yeah.
Like,
I loved it.
I mean, and I loved the whole movie.
Yeah, of course.
But that ending, like, next level. I don't always connect with the sort of... what's that word? Not experimental, but like...
Art house?
Whatever David Lynch does. Like, I don't always connect with that type. Yeah. That type of movie, but like for some reason it worked for me. I think because it's not everything that happens is in service of something, and I was able to identify what it was in service of, you know, like it wasn't completely over my head. Right. Like it was like he's obsessed with death, so all of this stuff is what he wants to do or what he wishes he could do or how he could see himself. Mm-hmm. And it's just another step removed from how Fosse actually saw himself.
Right.
So it's really interesting to look at it both from the perspective of what's going on screen and also why Fosse was making these choices mm-hmm. about himself. And I think that context is incredibly like illuminating for the whole thing. So if I didn't know it was about himself, I would be like, oh, that was a cool movie. But like knowing that he wrote everything about himself and his own life and his own regrets and all that, like that takes it to the next level.
It's kind of like people who are into art that see all of like the Picasso self-portraits and stuff.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, it shows you where he's at these times in his life and whatever. Or like Frida Kahlo, how like a lot of her work had herself in it.
Yeah. Surrealist is the word I was looking for.
Oh, there you go. Like this is kind of that in a different artistic format, which is really, really fascinating.
Well, to the point where, again, on that Blank Check podcast, Lin-Manuel Miranda had a copy of I think he went to like the Library of Congress or something mm-hmm. and got the, oh no, that was for Jonathan Larson's notes for Tick, Tick, Boom. But he had the first draft of the script for this movie, and Fosse's, in the original script, they're literally named for the people that they're based on. So like Joe Gideon isn't in the script. It's Bob Fosse. the MC is Sammy Davis.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The address, he even wrote the address on the pill bottle. You see like his Dexedrine
bottle? It was his real address?
It was one door over from where he actually lived.
He's so crazy.
I have the other ones here. Leland Palmer's character was based on Gwen Verdon. John Lithgow's character was based somewhat on a New York theater director named Michael Bennett, who was the director of Dreamgirls.
Well, and they specifically have someone ask for his autograph saying that besides Joe Gideon, you're my favorite director.
Yes, and him and Fosse had a longstanding rivalry.
There you go.
Another rival was in it. Anne Rankin was more or less playing herself. There was one of the songwriter, Paul.
Yeah.
Is a swipe at Stephen Schwartz, whom Fosse had unhappily worked on Pippin with.
I just love it. I love it.
This whole movie is like a diss track to everybody.
Yeah, I love that.
To everybody. And
that he was willing to go there and just say their names is so
in
funny.
The original script. They were all just in the script.
So good. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah.
You can't even pull the, oh, like likenesses are entirely coincidental if you do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he changed it for the final.
Of course.
But the first thing was literally like when they're talking about Joe Gideon, every time they say Joe Gideon in this movie, they're saying Bob or Bob Fosse. Yeah.
I love that. Oh my God. Imagine being Gwen Verdon. You're watching that. You're like, seriously? So, yeah, one of the things that I thought was really cool about our experience watching this was that we didn't know what it was about.
Nothing. No idea.
No idea. Like, I was expecting, like, Cabaret or Chicago. Something like that. Because that's what I think of Fosse. That's what I think of. Or Pippin or whatever. And so this was just a complete left turn from what I thought. And that made it more fun, I think, for me to watch. Because the movie's also an interesting movie. So I'm wondering, like, have you ever, we've done it like a little bit here and there, gone into a movie without any expectations or background on it? And do you like when you do that? Do you wish you did it more?
I've done that more the past couple of years since I've started really, really watching and actively seeking out certain movies.
Mm-hmm.
It depends, of course. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But even even like the stuff I've been watching, which is like I've been watching like older stuff and stuff from countries that I've never really explored and stuff from like eras I've never really explored. So like, but there's still always some kind of like preconceived notion.
Yeah.
And even with this movie, I did have the preconceived notion of thinking it was something like a cabaret or something like that. And it turned out to be something completely different. And the reason this works is because it turned out to be something different that I liked.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like a crapshoot. You never know, which we learned how to play craps a couple weeks ago, by the way.
It was so much fun. It was 1 week ago.
1 week ago.
Less than. It was six days ago.
And so, it's a kind of a cop-out answer, but it really does depend. This one was a smash, though, for sure.
Yeah. I think I want to do that more. Where I watch a movie without really knowing anything about it. And I think that if we do like older movies, I have a better chance of that happening. Because nowadays you're just so flooded with information about things before
trailers
it comes
and casting
out.
And directing.
Stills, and that, whatever. Yeah. Like people complained about Killers of the Flower Moon when it was just that one picture. But I liked that because then I don't know what it's going to be. Even though I did. You know what I mean? Like, I like when there's not a ton of information or you can't accidentally stumble upon it.
Yeah, my problem is with when, like, the fact that trailers are 3 minutes long.
Yeah.
Now, like, right. I can't watch them. I don't watch trailers. If it's something that I'm interested in, maybe I'll check out if there's, like, a minute-long teaser, like Roadhouse had.
Right.
The Gyllenhaal Roadhouse. But, like, I'm not going to actively seek out trailers because I don't want to see the whole movie.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I'll see it when it's on TV, like the 30-second ad.
Well, that's why Sundance is kind of cool.
Yeah.
We're not doing it this year, but we did it the past 2 years, the online thing that they have. And they don't have trailers out yet.
Right.
They like
the movies are like getting done. Like,
yeah, they're not even fully done sometimes or whatever. So like, unfortunately, we haven't had anything. I think Theater Camp was like a big hit for us. But like there hasn't been anything that's been like, oh my goodness, I'm obsessed.
There was one last year.
No, not the Bad Behavior one.
No, which we won't. We can't talk about the one. We can't talk about the one that was good.
Which one?
It's Getting Buried Forever.
Oh, yeah, we can't talk about that.
It's Magazine Dreams.
Yeah, that one. I don't know if that's ever going to get released.
Not for a while.
But some good news. When we did Killers of the Flower Moon, I mentioned Fancy Dance.
Yes.
Not getting
any. Which was a good one. Which was one that we really
liked. Good. A Lily Gladstone starring movie. And it got bought.
Yeah, it's coming
last week.
Coming
to Apple. So definitely check it out because we really liked it when we saw it last year.
It's a small little movie.
Yeah. So I kind of want to do that a little bit more where I'm watching movies without any expectations or background, especially if it's ones that I heard are really good. I just don't know much about it. Like this one.
That's kind of what I've been doing, and it works sometimes.
So what are some other movies that this reminds you of? Can I tell you, I did a drive home. Can I tell you some that I thought of?
Okay.
So you mentioned a couple of them actually after I had already been thinking about it on my drive. And I found that like, I feel like a lot of directors, it feels like they were inspired by this movie a lot. And I know that this movie was inspired by a lot of movies, which I don't know.
Especially
like
Eight and a Half,
which I had never seen.
That's one of those that I like randomly watched like last year.
Yeah. And that's Fellini.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. But I thought like Charlie Kaufman.
I literally turned to you and said, Charlie Kaufman owes his entire career to this movie.
We've mentioned
in a good way. I like Charlie Kaufman.
We've mentioned Adaptation a lot over the past year and change here. But it's very meta in the same way and very autobiographical and very much based in, it feels like an artist struggling
pressure and writer's block
with their art. Yeah. And then Synecdoche, New York, same thing. Like I felt like,
That was like dreamy, like this one is too.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Whereas Adaptation is not really like dreamy.
Right.
But Synecdoche is kind of surreal at times.
Wouldn't Philip Seymour Hoffman be the best Bob Fosse?
I don't know. He was a great Truman Capote.
Yeah. And then I thought definitely Darren Aronofsky as well.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned Black Swan as we were watching the movie.
The Wrestler.
And I felt like The Wrestler, same thing. Both of those, you have these kind of like art forms and you see the dark underbelly of it.
And Aronofsky says that the Wrestler and Black Swan are like sister films too. So,
well, that would make sense, yeah. Right? And then I think about the quick cuts of the beginning of Joe Gideon's day every day, and them being similar, and then the Alka-Seltzer and the Visine and the pills and the shower and the it's showtime. And it reminded me of some of those quick cuts in Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
Which is another Aronofsky film.
Another movie about obsession and being sort of, you know, turning to things to cope and mm-hmm. things like that.
Exactly. And then I even thought, like, oh, you kind of get some like Joker vibes. I don't know when King of Comedy came out, but I know Joker was very much inspired by that movie.
82.
Okay, so I haven't seen King of Comedy, but Joker...
By transitive property.
Joker felt very... I saw some qualities in that that I don't think were done as well. But were inspired by all that jazz for sure, particularly the scenes of the editing of the stand-up.
Yeah.
And...
The meme of him standing there looking into the light, and it's like just a lame joke.
Like, not even, yeah. And this idea of like someone kind of delving into madness almost, and these dream sequences. And then I thought to myself, well, yes, that was a Todd Phillips movie, but it was produced by Bradley Cooper. And Bradley Cooper's directorial effort this year, Maestro, I found a connection as well to this movie because. You've got Leonard Bernstein, who is seen as like one of the guys when it comes to his lane. And he did a lot of music for Broadway shows and things like that.
West Side Story.
Yeah, West Side Story. He was a composer. And he was like constantly facing this imposter syndrome based on this movie. That's all I know about him, really. And I felt like Joe Gideon or Bob Fosse felt that same way. Like, he was like, this, I hate what I did here. This doesn't work. I don't like this, blah, blah, blah. And I think that it's this kind of like, okay, let's face it. Bernstein knew he was good, just like Fosse knew he was good. But you still have that kind of underlying imposter syndrome, even from these guys that are like the guys. And it's, I found that also their relationships with the women in their lives where they were taken kind of in different directions. But in both of them, I feel like, and this is Bradley Cooper's not Leonard Bernstein. If Leonard Bernstein had made this movie,
right.
then it would have been different. But like in both of these movies, like it seemed like they gave featured roles to the women in their lives. And in both of them, like you can kind of see, especially in All That Jazz, I think like Fosse was trying to say that Verdon was like a true star by having his ex-wife in the movie do this big dance scene when she's talking about everything, whatever.
Yeah.
And same thing with Maestro, where like Carrie Mulligan gets her chance to shine and have the big scenes and have the big moments. But while Bernstein's character is by the end is humbled with the knowledge that like he basically Bradley Cooper calls his wife the maestro, right? Fosse's not going to do that.
No, no, he's
but
not.
But then again, Fosse's character ends up being zipped up in the body bag. So it's kind of an interesting kind of shift away in the way that the women are not treated necessarily, but how they're seen as muses and how that is kind of shifted and twisted on its head a little bit.
Well, then guess what? There's also a bunch of women in 8 and a half that... I don't want to say get retribution on the Fellini stand-in, who is played by Marcello Mastroianni, who's like the biggest Italian like actor of the time. But it's essentially the same thing. It's like he's a director. He's trying to make this big sci-fi movie. He can't figure out exactly how to do it. He has this woman character in his mind that is literally named in the cast the ideal woman, and he can't get that character. And the whole thing is about the studios bearing down on him, and he feels that he's like not capable of creating this movie because he's incapable of love and he's incapable of connection. And it's like this whole, the same thing. It's like just looking at himself. And it's like, it came out, I'm on the Wikipedia page right now. It came out in 1963. And it's like so many movies flow from this. And it's like, yes, you could take these movies, the Kaufman stuff, and you could be like, they look more like All That Jazz, and they could be more drawn from All That Jazz than 8 and a half. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like the, like, 8.5 is the top of the umbrella.
Yeah, of course.
And everything trickles down from it. And this is, I don't want to, Ebert said that that all that jazz was derivative of 8.5.
Ooh.
And I don't think I necessarily agree with that. It's his own take on,
right,
on the same idea. Mm-hmm. It's not, but Ebert said, since I don't have a review, I might as well just say it. He said that he didn't really follow this movie. He thought it was a bit too fragmented, and that he liked 8.5 better. And he said, I think it's kind of ironic. Bob Fosse makes a movie about his own life, and it turns out to be Fellini's life.
It's so good. I love Ebert.
He's obnoxious sometimes, but he's great. So just as much as it sort of influenced the movies that came after it, it was also absolutely influenced by 8.5. But I don't think that's necessarily bad or wrong, because everyone's experiences are different. Like, the things that Joe Gideon does in this movie are different from the things that, I forget the character's name in 8.5, Guido, does in 8.5. It's not, it's a different experience because it's a different life. It has similar themes and similar ideas because it's a director, whether you're directing a movie / musical, mm-hmm, or whether you're directing a fake science fiction movie. Mm-hmm. It's the same profession. So of course there are going to be things that overlap. They're both womanizers. Of course there's going to be things that overlap. But it doesn't make all that jazz any less authentic or able to be connected with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that all that jazz was excellent. I think they're both great. I wouldn't say that this is derivative at all, but I think that they're both great.
Well, and what, like, you're not going to like Tick, Tick, Boom, which came out a couple years ago, because it draws upon the same ideas a little bit.
Slightly different in the Maestro way, in that it's not made by the person who it's about, but same idea, yeah.
Yeah. And so Tick, Tick, Boom, if you haven't seen it, it's really good.
Yes.
And that's about Jonathan Larson, creator of Rent, who he was like making a musical, and he just like could not figure it out.
Well, Tick, Tick, Boom, it's all about the ticking clock of death. It's the same idea.
And weirdly, both Bob Fosse and Jonathan Larson passed of heart issues, which is, number one, really sad. And so did the screenwriter, Arthur.
Yeah.
But it also is kind of like morbidly poetic in a way.
And guess what? So did Fellini in his 70s, a little
older.
Oh,
my gosh.
Yeah.
What the heck? Be careful, Bradley Cooper.
And Lin-Manuel Miranda.
And Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Who directed Tick, Tick, Boom.
It is kind of a little ironic and kind of fascinating that you have these, like, it feels like your heart is so wrapped up in this art, you know what I mean?
Yeah
Really interesting stuff. One of my other questions here is, I just feel like the Roy Scheider performance surprised me and blew me away.
Okay,
so I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on how it ranks as far as other
Roy Scheider performances. Definitely top two that I've seen.
No, I mean just among like lead actor performances.
I watched this movie, if I didn't know anything about Roy Scheider's career, and I really don't, but I know that he never became a Jack Nicholson, a Gene Hackman, like a major star from this time. Robert Duvall, he never really became that, despite being in huge movies, The French Connection, Jaws, this. Marathon Man was pretty big. It had a huge cast. Dustin Hoffman was in it. If this was the only movie I had seen of him, I didn't know. I would think he was like one of the biggest stars in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He carries himself that way. The way that he delivers his line, like, he's a natural.
Yeah, he's amazing.
It's wild to me that he didn't have a mega star career.
Yeah.
And he was a star. He was nominated for this. He was a star at this time. He's a star.
Twice nominated.
His whole career, he's a star. But he never really reached that upper echelon in terms of like when you look back and think of even 70s movies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in three of the biggest ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I thought he was amazing.
Me too.
You have to, especially in a cast of people who aren't, it's not a star-studded cast.
No.
He had to carry this whole thing as the star of the, like, Jaws had already happened. This was the third of the big three in the 70s.
Jaws happened?
74.
Five. Yeah, you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, five.
Yep.
French Connection, I think, was 71.
Yeah.
And so, like, he's already established. He's the guy. It all falls on his shoulders, and he knocks it out of the park. He was amazing.
I think that he's so well cast because I mean, I don't really know much about like Bob Fosse and how he carried himself and how he looked and things like that. But like Roy Scheider is not necessarily the like debonair leading man type.
Right.
In look. And so the casting's really good because he's a guy who could lean a little creepy or he could lean a little family man like in Jaws, like an everyman, but he doesn't do that in this. Like he's a little off, a little like he's like really skinny and he's got like the crazy eyes and he's a little wrinkled and just like furrowed brow the whole time. But he's charming.
Well, I think the reason for that is he's got like the sunken eyes. He's got bags under his
going
eyes.
Going through it.
But if you look at Roy Scheider, like he has a look in his eye that just makes you want to connect with. Like it's something in his eyes.
And that is so important because you need to be likable.
This character is not likable, but I liked him. But
I liked him.
I liked watching him in this movie.
Yeah.
He's terrible. He's touching the nurses.
Oh, he's awful.
He's doing drugs. He's like neglecting his daughter.
Terrible employer.
Terrible. Terrible.
But he's really likable.
Casting people so that he can hook up with them.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Like,
just turn after turn every horrible. Single day doing awful things.
But Scheider is so good that he makes you sad at the end.
Yeah. You're
throughout
like,
the whole sequence.
Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah.
And I think that's all on Scheider. Like nothing Fosse did in this movie, like from what I understand.
Is redeemable.
Not redeemable, but is nothing that was written for the. If you write everything, all this down on paper, there's like maybe one or two scenes with the daughter and you know, the dancing scene.
But even that
scene,
could be a little creepy.
Yeah. But the dancing scene with the mom and daughter.
Yeah.
When he's like sitting on the couch. Like, yeah, that's a cute scene.
Yeah.
Like, there's a couple little things in there, but that's really
I
it.
I thought it was with the girlfriend and the daughter.
The girlfriend and the daughter, yeah. Sorry. And
yeah, you're right.
I think there's, like, tiny little redeemable parts, but it's on Scheider to make me like him throughout the movie. And he does it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to see Joe go, but, you know.
Bye-bye life.
Yeah, exactly.
My final question, I just like to do a favorite and least favorite thing about this movie.
Okay, you want to go first?
I'll think about it. Yeah. So something that I really liked about it was besides, I think the lead performance, which I was truly blown away by it.
Yeah.
I just like the, I just think the authenticity of it felt really, really real to me. Number one, 70s movies have that certain sheen to them. I love the look of a 70s movie. And it was there. But you could just tell that like, this was like, Bob Fosse felt this way.
Yeah.
It felt real. And I really like seeing kind of that inside of being inside of someone who I truly believe is an artistic genius.
I don't know enough about him, but enough people have told me he's an artistic genius for me to respect that.
And so he's amazing. And so what he was able to accomplish.
It's weird. I don't know much about him, but I know everything about him now.
Yeah.
After this movie.
Yeah. Right. And to be kind of, to have him let you inside of his, idiosyncrasies, is that how you say that word?
Yeah.
And his what he finds to be his own flaws, and to which we all would probably agree, and to kind of just lay them bare out there, and then to do it in a way where it ends in a half an hour of a music sequence is
which
just,
is what he's the best at.
It's like king behavior.
It's also, there's another wrinkle to it too. It's like he's By putting himself on camera like this in such a negative light, you could wonder if he's sort of saying, if I put this out there, you can't criticize me for it.
Yeah.
You know? So it's almost a defense mechanism at the same time as it is an expose.
But it's also like,
which I just find interesting. It's another layer to it.
And it's also interesting because only someone who's very narcissistic,
he's incredibly narcissistic,
would be like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to talk about how I had such a hard time making this critically acclaimed movie and this amazingly received
musical
that will soon become the musical that's on Broadway the longest time ever, not that he'll be alive for it, and win Best Picture in a few decades. Yeah. Oh my God. That was so hard.
Tough time in my life.
Oh, it was such a hard time and I'm so annoying, but look at this movie that I made that starred Dustin Hoffman and I was nominated for all these Oscars. And oh my God, I made this amazing musical and oh, isn't it so annoying how much I hate this dance style that I made up and that now everyone calls the Fosse style. Oh my God.
It is very much that, but it's still charming.
Oh, I know. I love it. I love it. So that's my favorite thing about it. Just that the layers of the idea of kind of just jumping into this guy's psyche is so good, especially because he was already mega famous at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I love that. Like, that's the thing. Like, with Tick, Tick, Boom, like, Jonathan Larson, he was not at the peak of where he would have been if he had lived.
If he lived to even see Rent. See, if he lived a couple more months.
A day.
I know, but, like, by the time it all, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And so... like that, it's like, oh, it's really sad. It's that star that's burning out too soon, right? Yeah. And it's a tragic story and whatever. You don't feel as bad for Fosse. Like, you feel devastated at the end of Tick, Tick, Boom. Like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened to him. Yeah. Like, with Fosse, with all like, that jazz at the end, you're like, well
yeah.
And it's just amazing that someone at the top of his game like that would be willing to put himself out there in a wide release film like that.
Well, Warren Beatty was approached about playing Joe Gideon, and he said, only if he lives at the end.
Well.
And it's like, Warren.
It's like, not the point.
Death is the point of this movie. Right. If he had gotten the girl and he had left and he had done it, gotten everything, he's, you know, it's just, it's a sweet saccharine melodrama.
Right.
It's not what all that jazz is.
Right.
It's a completely different movie.
Yeah.
The ending is the movie.
Right.
And it really, like, hammers it home. Warren, I'm sure he would have been good. I'm sure he would have been great. This was the way to go.
Yeah. As far as things that I didn't like as much, I mean...
I'm just going to co-sign because I totally agree on the best part.
Yeah. I truly don't think that there's anything that I really would necessarily criticize about the movie.
It's hard.
Because it feels... It's so personal and it's so...
Like, who am I to say what his choices would have been?
It's just, it's very dark and it's not one that I'll revisit every 2 seconds. You know what I mean? It's not one of those for me personally. And it's very rated R.
It is very rated R. Including, again, as we mentioned, open heart surgery.
Yeah. And that part is probably the most violent part of the movie.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff in it that is, again,
he doesn't
art.
Pull punches.
Yeah. And that's fine. I just can't show my kid earlier.
Right.
You know. What about you? Do you have a least favorite part?
I don't want to say it's least favorite because as you saw me do a moment ago, I confused two of the female parts.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, like, maybe differentiating, but...
That's kind of the point.
That's kind of the point. Like, yeah. In his life, all these women are interchangeable to him.
And there's even a part at the end where his daughter's wearing makeup and stuff where she even looks like these other women.
Yeah.
And at first, I didn't even realize it was her.
Yeah.
And again, it's so purposeful.
And it's like what he's doing in his life is turning her into somebody who's going to be victimized by people like him.
Right. It's good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's an achievement.
Yeah.
So that is not my least favorite part because it makes sense in an artistic sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is dark. It is dark. I don't mind watching dark movies as much. Like, I could, because I don't know, I can kind of detach myself a little bit easier, I think. But I don't know. I thought the movie was great. I don't really have anything bad to say about it, honestly.
Love that. That's all I got for questions.
All right, I have a couple. Let's see. Do you have any other favorite, like, tortured artist movies?
Because
we've talked about a couple, the Kaufman stuff, Eight and a Half is like that too. Anything else?
Yeah, Amadeus.
Amadeus.
Which I'm talking about Salieri.
Huh?
I'm talking about Salieri. He's my tortured artist.
They're both tortured artists.
Nah, no. Amadeus was having
We watched that last year. I watched it on a recommendation from the Discord.
That movie was Discord. So good.
I loved Amadeus.
I could not believe how good that
was. We watched
movie
the 3-hour director's cut too. We watched the long version.
It was so good. Like, I can't get over it. And again, amazing performance.
Yeah,
he was like amazing. And Amadeus, that movie is just so good.
Yeah, I didn't think I was gonna like it at all. I was like, a period piece movie, classical music. No, yeah, it's awesome.
So there's my tortured artist for you.
Whiplash.
Oh, that's a good one.
Whiplash is, you could argue that J.K. Simmons is also a tortured artist as well as Miles Teller in that movie.
Yeah.
I'm on a Reddit thread right now. Someone said All That Jazz should be perfect for you. Of course, we mentioned Black Swan, the wrestler.
Yeah.
There's just I you know, Joker again. Like all these movies, these are all the ones that we kind of already talked about.
Nice. What about La La Land?
La La Land probably counts. I mean, there's the whole like racial thing with that, where it's like a jazz white savior thing that it's gotten criticism for.
Gosling. Yeah, for sure.
But I don't know. Maybe, I guess, in terms of like when he,
I feel like Damien Chazelle, just in general, all his movies, like Babylon 2.
Yeah, not really First Man.
I don't know. Maybe he was going through it.
Yeah, I think that's a good set. Because again, we kind of talked about, what about Phantom Thread?
Oh, that's good stuff.
Phantom Thread's great.
Phantom Thread's wild.
Again, not a movie I thought I would like. A period piece about a dressmaker.
Yeah.
What? But then it's Daniel Day-Lewis and it's Paul Thomas Anderson. So, and it's Leslie Manville.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do about it?
Queen.
Okay. Do you like the title of this movie?
I love it. I think it's perfect.
It is, again, not what I expected.
Right.
It led me to believe that it was a different movie.
Yeah.
But it's a perfect title for this movie.
So this is why I like it. And I didn't look anything up for it, so I might be completely off base. But number one, All That Jazz is like a turn of phrase, right? Where it's just like, oh, you know, and all that jazz. And
they say it in the movie.
I know they do, yeah. But they also, it's a thing where it's like, it can be used to be for like such mundane things too. Like if you say, oh, I did that and then all that jazz and blah, blah, blah. Like it's not always meant to be that jazz, right? Yeah. And then also, it's one of the like big songs in Chicago and all that jazz.
Yeah.
And so that's something that like is part of the movie.
It's like a triple entendre.
It's so like, oh my God.
So O'Connor Flood, who is the MC, who's like the MC of the whole dream sequence, or, you know, sequence at the end, the death sequence. He says, folks, what can I tell you about my next guest? This cat allowed himself to be adored but not loved, and his success in show business was matched by failure in his personal relationship bag now. That's where he really bombed. And he came to believe that show business, work, love, his whole life, even himself and all that jazz, was BS. And he goes on to this whole thing. He introduces Mr. Joe Gideon. Mm-hmm. And that's the movie. It's everything that you're seeing. Like once that zipper on the body bag is zipped up, all like nothing else matters. This is all nonsense. All the stuff that he did in this movie is nonsense because it doesn't matter. He feels that none of it is going to matter after he dies.
Right.
Everything's pointless, and that he is all this art he's putting out there. It's not good. It's not going to stick. It's not going to stay. Zip it up. It's over. When he's dead, everything's dead. And he's wrong, because we're watching all that jazz. It's a, you know. Like you said, so much of his influence is seen all throughout Broadway and movies and all that. Like he's influenced a lot. So he wasn't necessarily correct about that. But all that jazz is literally him just saying, like, in Joe Gideon's life, none of this matters because he was he was a crappy person. He never was able to sort of bring himself around and be there for any of the women in his life, his daughter, any of his girlfriends. He just mistreated himself and he mistreated everybody around him, and then zip it up, it's all over. It's a perfect title for this movie.
It's kind of interesting now that I think about it with like these men that are like super fascinated with death that are involved in this, the artisticness of it all. Bruce Springsteen, it's the same. He's in that era right now.
Yeah.
Where he is very obsessed, I think, with death. And did you get that from Born to Run, his memoir?
Yeah.
Springsteen on Broadway, it's on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, it's really, really, really well done. Like all of his childhood friends, like from his first band and stuff, like are dead. And so it's this kind of like,
he's losing people from his
current band. Yeah. A couple people have passed from his, from the E Street band. And, so I think that he has this kind of sense of mortality. And a couple of months ago, Shane McGowan, the lead singer of the Pogues, died. And Springsteen's reaction was fascinating to me. He said, I don't know about the rest of us, but we'll remember, like the world will remember Shane McGowan. And I think it's that same thing of like, you don't think we're going to remember Born to Run? You don't think that that's gonna stick? Like, it's interesting, but you know that Springsteen's not, like, you know he knows that.
Yeah. Well, because he's also a narcissist in his own way.
It's so fascinating. And it's
how these people keep themselves going to keep creating great art.
Yeah.
Like they always have to have a chip on their shoulder.
Yeah. It's really, really fascinating.
And it's kind of like how Martin Scorsese is now obsessed with dying.
Yeah, he is. Yep.
Like he's talked about, like, I'm in my 80s. Like I have so much more to say, but I don't know how long I'm going to get to say it. And he's like freaking out about it.
Yeah. And it's like, my guy, like you did Goodfellas though.
You did Goodfellas, but you also kind of did like the same movie a bunch of times. But no, it's like I feel like in order to be a great artist, a lot of times a common thread is that you realize that there's an end to this rope, and you need to get out as much of it as possible before you get to that end. Yeah. For the tick tick boom, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Lin-Manuel Miranda said on when he rewatched All That Jazz, there's a couple scenes like I think it's in the repeating morning routine where the clock is ticking, and he was like, it gave me chills because like I didn't even realize I got that from All That Jazz.
Like well, he's another one. I know that people think that he's like corny and
I do think
he is a genius.
I do think that in a lot of ways, but he is a genius, and I highly highly recommend the Blank Check podcast on this movie. It's 2 hours long if you have 2 hours, which is almost as long as the movie, but highly recommend it because he's great. It's the perfect topic for him to be talking about.
He's awesome.
Remember the lady who was reviewing and rating movies with the balloons? She was like, oh, half a balloon for the movie. And she deflated the balloon. I love that. I just wrote that down. And you know that that's based on a real person too. I don't know who that was, but.
There's some really funny moments.
Yeah.
And secretly funny moments in this movie.
Yeah. I wrote, kind of sad for an anxious artist like Fosse to simultaneously show the heart surgery scene as visceral as it gets. And it's cutting back and forth with the guys in the boardroom, essentially breaking down his worth and how if he dies, they would make more money than if he lived.
Well, it's so just like, look at me. I'm on this table, heart open, giving my all to this project. And the people that aren't involved, the people that are dealing with the money side of it, these guys, they don't care. They're not putting themselves out there. And look, it's all about money for them. While I'm laid out bare and for the world. It's just so like dramatic.
Yeah. It's a really bleak.
Yeah.
A really bleak view. I wonder what Fosse would think of the studio system now, because that's even more.
Oh, yeah.
Fosse would not be able to have made all that. It would have been Beau Is Afraid. You would have seen it. You would have heard about it. But it wouldn't have made like a big. It wouldn't have made a ton of money.
Right.
Like. It's and that's another one that I'm sure was heavily influenced by these types of movies. Beau Is Afraid, the Ari Aster movie with Joaquin from last year. But yeah, I loved that simulcasting of those two.
It's good stuff.
Those two things.
Nice juxtaposition.
And then literally right before the hospital scene is over, it transitions to all the suits talking about how relieved they are that he lived and like doing that whole thing.
Nice early John Lithgow role.
Yeah. The other thing I liked about the ending was that it like it's the whole sequence, the whole like sensory overload and the songs and the people and the dancing and all that. And then it's just a hard cut to the body bag.
Yeah.
Silence.
Silence.
And it's like it's sterile and it's cold and it's like fluorescent lighting, but it's kind of peaceful, too.
Yeah.
It's like cathartic almost for him. It's like all this frantic chaos that he's been going through, all the turmoil in his brain and his body and his soul. Like that whole, again, it brings you back to the whole melodrama of the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Like it's just cold and it's all gone and that's it. All that jazz. Yeah. Crazy. Crazy ending. The only other thing that I have a couple little notes, but the daughter, the actress who played the daughter only did this movie.
Interesting.
She was great.
She was great.
That's a role that like you have to draw the pathos out of out of Joe, and I thought she did a really good job at it. Elizabeth Foldy, she doesn't have a Wikipedia page. Only movie she ever did.
Wow.
And that wasn't even my trivia.
She was a good dancer too.
Yeah. This is not technically my trivia, but I will say it because y'all replaced the Kubrick one. So I'll do Tom's top five trivia. My first one: this movie was shot by Fellini's regular cinematographer.
There you go,
Giuseppe Rotondo.
Hey, Giuseppe.
He didn't do 8.5, but he did a lot of Fellini movies, which was just I'm sure not a coincidence.
Interesting little tidbit.
Richard Dreyfuss was originally cast as Joe Gideon, Jaws guy.
Vibes.
But he departed during the rehearsal stage because he didn't think it was going to be any good. And then he said he made a mistake.
Yeah.
I believe his exact quote was, "Nobody wants to see my big Jewish ass dancing on that stage."
Why would he think that?
I don't know.
That is like crazy.
That was his actual quote.
Why? No one would think that.
Rich. He would have been great too. He's great.
He's great.
On the Blu-ray audio commentary, it is revealed that Roy Scheider had many unusual lessons from Bob Fosse throughout filming, which included coughing lessons. Because Gideon's a chain smoker who coughed very heavily, and Fosse was like showing him how to do it properly. Also, during the heart attack scene, Fosse described to Scheider how painful it was, as if someone was pressing a weight to his chest. So during the performance of the scene off camera, the first assistant director pressed one knee on Scheider's chest while the camera was capturing his painful expressions. Four. The budget blew up from $6.5 million to $10 million. Fosse went over budget before filming the final sequence, which is just like in the movie. The musical goes over before it films the big sequence, or before they are able to fund it. Columbia Pictures refused to give him any more money, so at an impasse, executives privately showcased much of what was already shot for the president of 20th Century Fox. Impressed, he agreed that Fox would finance the remainder of the shoot. He also asked for and received distribution and cable rights. Profits were split according to the contract, though Fox received top billing in the credits. Because I guess because they saved it.
Yeah.
And finally, Bob Fosse continued to chain smoke unfiltered cigarettes while promoting the movie to the incredulity of interviewers who asked how he could do so after suffering two heart attacks and making a movie featuring the destructive effects of drugs and chain smoking on his alter ego's health. Fosse joked that he cut back to 5 packs a day.
Oh, that's good.
Some casting. Fosse wanted to play Joe.
Yeah.
Producer David H. Melnick pointed out that because of his heart problems, he would never survive the shoot.
Oh, my God.
Dustin Hoffman was offered and said he'd never work with Fosse again after Lenny. The studio wanted Warren Beatty, as I noted. Robert Duvall, Gene Hackman, and Nicholson were all considered. These were like all the biggest stars of the time.
Yeah, of course they were all considered.
Jack Lemmon was considered by the studio, but Fosse said he was too old.
Too old. Although that would have been great casting 15 years earlier.
Oh, without a doubt. So Anne Rankin, who played Katie Jagger, I mentioned, is essentially herself. She still had to audition.
So typical.
Multiple times, it says here.
Well, that's like the whole opening scene, right?
Yeah.
Casting call.
And then I've seen conflicting sort of thoughts on which character she was supposed to play, but either Audrey or Angelique was offered to Shirley MacLaine, and she said no.
Oh, really?
Probably Audrey, because she's like the older actress.
That would be my guess.
As opposed to like the Jessica Lange role.
Yep.
But yeah, I love Shirley MacLaine. Everything I've seen her in, she's awesome.
She's a queen.
No, I think that's it.
Great.
So does all that jazz make Baby's First Watch List?
I mean, yeah, later.
Yeah, eventually. And I'll close with one thing that they also said on the Blank Check podcast, which was, you can't recommend this to some random friend. Like,
no.
Because no matter whether they like it or not, they're going to be like,
why did you recommend
this? Why did you choose me for this? Why did you think I would like this? I thought that was a perfect way to describe this movie. So like, yeah, I mean, if my kid's into Fellini, if he's into Tick, Tick, Boom, if he's into musicals, if he's into Fosse, sure, check it out.
Yeah.
You know, when he's of a reasonable age, late teens, something like that.
Late teens.
At the earliest.
Late teens is around, right?
But
late high school, senior year of high school kind of thing.
But like, you got to be into this stuff.
Yeah.
Or something adjacent to it.
Yeah. Or into film.
Right. I don't mean into like musical. Like I like musicals, but I don't consider myself like a Broadway buff. Like I don't know much about Broadway.
You're much more into musicals than you used to be.
Yeah, the more I watch, the more I like.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this one, it's got a lot. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
I think we are in the right stage of life as non-artists.
Mm-hmm. Speak for yourself.
To watch this movie. Yes, former actress in Bye Bye Birdie, Florence High School's Bye Bye Birdie in 2010.
Yes, that's correct.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's a masterpiece.
It is.
It really is. I would definitely recommend it if he was, or they, you know, next child as well. Next boy.
Yep.
is into something adjacent to this, then sure, check it out. It's definitely a movie that I think is a great movie. Yeah, so that's all that jazz. Thanks for sticking around. And thanks for, I don't know, I didn't say I was sick in this episode, but I'm a little raspy.
We're always sick over here.
Yeah, I just didn't explicitly say it this time. So yeah, thanks for sticking around. And next week is the movie I picked for my birthday. Not to brag, I'm turning 81 this week.
Yeah, you're looking pretty good.
It is going to be The Princess Bride.
Woo!
Which is, bar none, one of my favorite movies of all time.
It's a great movie.
And Wallace Shawn, who plays Vizzini in The Princess Bride, the inconceivable guy, was in All That Jazz.
Yeah, he was.
He had a very small role in All That Jazz.
We should have kept it going. Isn't he in Clueless?
Yeah, he's in Toy Story.
We should have Shawned it out.
Yeah. We're going to do Wallace Shawn month. We're going to have a total of four listens across the episode. No, and it's Nick Pelessi every time. So next week we're going to do Princess Bride. Then we're going to close out the month with another Best Picture nominee, American Fiction.
Yep.
Pumped.
I'm excited.
Excited for it. So please like, subscribe, do all that jazz.
Good one.
And keep sharing our clips and all that. So yeah, thank you again for tuning in, and we will see you next week for The Princess Bride.
Goodbye.
See ya.
Have fun storming the castle.